vegetable rows flourished. Textbook tomatoes, peas, beans, and carrots. The next four rows were not quite as productive. As he followed the increasingly frantic light on the EMF reader, the rows thinned further. The final three were merely strips of bare dirt pointed toward the distant fields. A few desiccated vines curled up the bamboo stakes, nothing but skeletons. The instruments guided the gray man to a rose bush planted on the other side of the dead rose, directly in front of a concrete well cover. Unlike the dry vines, the rose was hyper-alive. Above an ordinary green trunk, dozens of twisted shoots clawed from the old canes, contorting tightly around one another. Each mutated cane was tinged the florid red of new growth. It looked eerily as if blood ran through them. The new shoots bristled with malevolent red spines. The ultimate result of this furious growth was apparent in the blackened knots of branches above. Dead. The rose was growing itself to death. The gray man was impressed by the deep wrongness of it. A few waves of the meters confirmed that the energy was centered directly on the bush or the ground beneath it. An energy anomaly could possibly explain its hideous overgrowth. He didn't see, however, how it could be connected to the Grey Warren. Unless... Glancing toward the house, he set down his machines and hefted up the well's lid. The EMF reader screamed, every light furiously red. The magnetometer's reading spiked jaggedly. Cool air spiraled out of the impenetrably dark opening. He had a flashlight in the car, but he didn't think it would begin to pierce the depths. He contemplated what it would take to retrieve an object hidden in a well if it came to that. Just as suddenly as they'd started, both of the machines went quiet. Startled, he gave them an experimental swing of his arm. Nothing. Carried them around the rosebush. Nothing. Hung them over the well. Nothing. Whatever spurt of wild energy had brought him here was gone. It was possible, he thought, that the Grey Warren was something that worked in pulses, and it had just shut off from its hiding place in the well. But it was more possible, he thought, that this had to do with Hepco's little problem. The same energy surges that affected the stadium power might be at work here, escaping from this water source, somehow poisoning that blackened rose. The gray man replaced the well cover, wiped a sheen of sweat from the back of his neck, and straightened. He took a photo of the rose with his phone, and then he headed back to the car. 8. Adam Parrish had bigger problems than Ronan's dreams. For starters, his new home. These days, he lived in a tiny room above the St. Agnes Rectory. The entire place had been built in the late 1700s and looked it. Adam was constantly smashing his head heroically against sloped ceilings and jabbing lethal splinters into his sock feet. The entire room had that smell of very old houses, plaster must and timber dust and forgotten flowers. He had provided the furnishings, a flat IKEA mattress on the bare floor, plastic bins and cardboard boxes as nightstands and desk, a rug found on sale for $3. It was nothing, but it was Adam Parrish's nothing. How he hated and loved it. How proud he was of it. How wretched it was. Adam Parrish's nothing lacked air conditioning. There was no escaping the heat of a Virginian summer. He was too familiar with the sensation of sweat trickling down the inside of his pants leg. And then there were the three part-time jobs that paid his Aglinby tuition. He crammed in the work hours now to afford a more leisurely fall when school started. He'd spent just 2 hours at the easiest of the jobs, Boyd's Body and Paint, LLC, replacing brake pads and changing oil and finding what was making that squeaking noise there, no, there, and now, even though he was off, he was ruined for anything else. Sticky and sore and, above all else, tired, always tired. Little lights danced at the corner of his vision as he chained his bike to the staircase outside his place. Swiping the back of his sweaty hand over the front of his sweaty forehead, he climbed the stairs and realized Blue was waiting at the top. Blue Sargent was pretty in a way that was physically painful to him. He was attracted to her like a heart attack. Currently, she sat against his door in lace leggings and a tunic made of a ripped-up, oversized Beatles shirt. She had been paging idly through the supermarket's weekly saver, but she put it down when she saw him. The only rub was, Blue was another troubling thing. She was like Gansey in that she wanted him to explain himself. "What do you want, Adam? What do you need, Adam?" Want and need were words that got eaten smaller and smaller. Freedom. Autonomy. A perennial bank balance. A stainless steel condo in a dustless city. A silky black car. To make out with Blue. 8 hours of sleep. A cell phone. A bed. To kiss Blue just once. A blisterless heel. Bacon for breakfast? To hold Blue's hand. 1 hour of sleep. Toilet paper. Deodorant. A soda. A minute to close his eyes. What do you want, Adam? To feel awake when my eyes are open. "Hey," she said, "you've got mail." He knew. He'd already seen the ignored, unopened envelope emblazoned with Aglenby Academy's Raven Crest. For 2 days he'd been stepping over it as if it might disappear if he failed to acknowledge it. He'd already gotten his grades, and the envelope wasn't fat enough for the quarterly fundraising gala information. It might be just an alumni banquet or a photo book advertisement. The school was always sending out notices for opportunities to enhance the Aglenby experience. Summer camps and flying lessons, deluxe yearbooks and custom Raven emblazoned apparel. These Adam threw out. They were meant for the eyes of affluent parents in houses decorated with framed images of their children. But this time, he didn't think it was a fundraiser notification. He stooped to retrieve it, then hesitated, fingers on the doorknob. "Are you coming in? I need a shower." There was a beat. This was easier, Adam thought suddenly, when we didn't know each other. Blue said, "You can take one. I don't mind. Just figured I'd come say hi before my shift." He played the key in the lock and let them both in. They stopped in the center of the room, the only place they could stand without ducking. "So," she said. "So," he said. "What's new at work?" Adam struggled to think of an anecdote. His mind was a box he tipped out at the end of his shifts. "Yesterday, Boyd asked me if I wanted to be his tech for his next season. Rally season." "What does that mean?" "I'd have a job after I graduated. I'd be gone 6 or 7 weeks out of the year." It had been a flattering offer, actually. Most of the mechanics who traveled with Boyd had been at it far longer than Adam. Blue guessed. "You said no." He glanced at her. He couldn't read her as easily as he could read Gansey. He couldn't tell if she was pleased or disappointed. "I'm going to college." He didn't add that he wasn't killing himself at Aglenby to end up a fancy mechanic. That might have been good enough if he hadn't known what else was out there. If he hadn't grown up next door to Aglenby Academy. If you never saw the stars, candles were enough. She poked a toe at a half-rebuilt fuel pump sitting on newspapers. "Yep." There was something there, lurking just behind her answer. Some private distress. He touched her face. "Something wrong?" It was not quite fair. He knew that his touch would distract both of them from the question. Sure enough, Blue closed her eyes. He pressed his palm on her cool cheek, then after a pause down her neck. His hand was hyper-aware of what it was feeling. The stray hairs at the base of her neck, the faint tackiness of her skin that came from the memory of the sun, the lump of her throat moving as she swallowed. He captured her with his other hand, pulling her closer, carefully. Now she was pressed against him, close enough for him to be self-conscious of his sweaty t-shirt. His chin rested on the top of her head. Her arms linked loosely around him. He felt her breath heat the fabric of his shirt. He couldn't forget that his hip bone was pressed against her. It wasn't enough. He ached inside. But there was a line he wasn't allowed to cross, and he was never sure where it started. Surely this was close to it. He felt dangerous and kinetic. Then her fingers cautiously pressed into his back, feeling his spine. He hadn't gone too far then. He leaned in to kiss her. Blue tore herself from his arms. She actually tripped in her haste to get away. Her head knocked against the slanted ceiling. "I said no," she gasped, hand clapped on the back of her skull. Something stung in him. Like 6 weeks ago. "It's still no." They stared at each other, both hurt. "Just," she said, "just not kissing." He still ached. His skin was a constellation of nerve endings. "I don't understand." Blue touched her lips as if they had been kissed. "I told you." He just wanted an answer. He wanted to know if it was him or if it was her. He didn't know how to ask it, but he did anyway. "Did something happen to you?" Her face was blank for a moment. "What? Oh, no. Does there have to be a reason? The answer's just no. Isn't that good enough?" The correct answer was yes. He knew it. But the real answer was that he wanted to know if he had bad breath, or if she was only doing this with him because he was the first one to ask her, or if there was some other obstruction that he wasn't considering. "I'm going to take a shower," he said. He tried not to let it sound like he was still hurt, but he was, and it did. "You going to be here when I get back out? When's your shift start?" "I'll wait." She tried not to let it sound like she was hurt, but she was, and it did. While Blue paged through a few maps he had on his plastic bedstand, Adam stood in a cold shower until his heart stopped steaming. "What do you want, Adam?" He didn't even know. From inside the sloped old shower, he caught a half-image of himself in the mirror and startled. For a moment, something about his own reflection had seemed wrong. His wide eyes and gaunt face peered back at him, troubled but not unusual. And just like that, he was thinking of Cabe's water again. Some days he felt he didn't think of anything else. He hadn't owned many things in his life, properly owned them, him and no one else, but now he did. This bargain. It had been a little over a month since he'd offered his sacrifice to Cabe's water in order to wake Gansey's ley line. The entire ritual felt swimmy and surreal in his mind, like he'd been watching himself perform it on a television screen. Adam had gone fully prepared to make a sacrifice, but he wasn't quite sure how the specific one he'd eventually made had come to him. "I will be your hands. I will be your eyes." So far, nothing had happened. Not really. Which was almost worse. He was a patient with a diagnosis that he couldn't understand. In the shower, Adam scratched a thumbnail across his summer brown skin. The line of his nail went from white to angry red in a moment, and as he studied it, it struck him that there was something odd about the flow of the water across his skin, as if it was in slow motion. He followed the stream of water up to the showerhead and spent a full minute watching it sputter from the metal. His thoughts were a confusion of translucent drops clinging to metal and rain trembling off green leaves. He blinked. There was nothing odd about the water. There were no leaves. He needed to get some sleep before he did something stupid on the job. Climbing out of the shower, his spine aching, shoulders aching, soul aching, Adam dried and dressed slowly. He feared, hoped, that Blue might have left after all. But when he opened the bathroom door, scrubbing his hair dry, he discovered that she stood at the door, talking cheerfully to someone. The visitor turned out to be St. Agnes's office lady, her black hair curled in the humidity. She probably had an official title that Ronan knew, sub-nun or something, but Adam only knew her as Mrs. Ramirez. She seemed to do everything a church required to keep it running, short of saying Mass. including the collection of Adam's monthly rent check. When he saw her, his stomach plummeted. He was filled with the certainty that his last check had bounced. She would tell him there were insufficient funds, and Adam would scramble to push money into the yawning hole of the account, and then he'd have to pay a returned check fee to the bank, and another one to Mrs. Ramirez, getting further behind on his next month's rent, an endless pathetic loop of insufficiency. Voice thin, he asked, "What can I do for you, ma'am?" Her expression shifted. She wasn't sure how to say what needed to be said. Adam's fingers tightened on the doorframe.
"Oh, sweetie," she said, "I'm just letting you know about the rent on your little room here."
"I'm so done," he thought. "No more, please, I can't take any more."
"Well, we got a new tax assessment," she started, "for this building. And you know how we charge you as a non-profit. So your rent's going to change. It's got to stay the same percentage of the, building costs. It's $200 less."
Adam heard 200 and wilted, and then he heard the rest and thought he must have misunderstood. "Less? Each year?"
"Each month."
Blue looked delighted, but Adam couldn't quite accept that his rent had just dropped by 2/3. $2,400 a year suddenly freed up. His dubious Henrietta accent slid out before he could stop it. "Why did you say it was changing?"
"Tax assessment."
She laughed at his suspicion.
"Those taxes don't normally work out on the happy side, do they?"
She waited for Adam to answer, but he didn't know what to say. Finally, he managed. "Thank you, ma'am." As Blue closed the door, he drifted back to the center of the room. He still couldn't quite believe it. No, wouldn't believe it. It just didn't track. He retrieved the letter from Aglenby. Sinking onto his flat mattress, he finally opened it. Its contents were very thin indeed, just a single-spaced letter on Aglenby letterhead. It didn't take long to convey its message. The following year's tuition was increasing to cover additional costs, although his scholarship was not. They understood the tuition raise presented a hardship for him, and he was an exceptional student, but they needed to remind him, with as much kindness as possible, that the waiting list for Aglenby was quite long, inhabited by exceptional boys able to pay full tuition. In conclusion, they reminded Mr. Parrish that 50% of the next year's tuition was due by the end of the month in order to hold his place. The difference in tuition between this year's and next was $2,400. That number again. It couldn't be a coincidence. "Do you want to talk about it?" Blue asked, sitting down beside him. He didn't want to talk about it. Gansey had to be behind it. He knew Adam would never accept the money from him, so he'd engineered all of this. Persuaded Mrs. Ramirez to take a check and manufacture a tax assessment to cover his tracks. Gansey must have gotten a matching tuition notice 2 days ago. The raise wouldn't have meant anything to him. For a brief moment, he imagined life as Gansey must live it. The car keys in his pocket, the brand new shoes on his feet, the careless glance at the monthly bills. They couldn't hurt Gansey. Nothing could hurt him. People who said money couldn't buy everything hadn't seen anyone as rich as the Aglenby boys. They were untouchable, immune to life's troubles. Only death couldn't be swiped away by a credit card. "One day," Adam thought miserably, "one day that will be me." But this ruse wasn't right. He would have never asked for Gansey's help. Adam wasn't sure how he would have covered the tuition raise, but it was not this, not Gansey's money. He pictured it, a folded-over check, hastily pocketed, gazes not met. Gansey relieved that Adam had finally come to his senses, Adam unable to say thank you. He became aware that Blue was watching him, her lips pursed, eyebrows tight. "Don't look at me like that," he said. "Like what? I'm not allowed to be worried about you?" Heat hissed through his voice. "I don't want your pity." If Gansey wasn't allowed to pity him, Blue sure as hell wasn't allowed to.
She and Adam were in the same boat after all. Wasn't she on her way to work the same as he'd just come from it? Blue said, then don't be pitiful. Anger snarled up in him, instantly owning him. It was a binary emotion in the parishes. No such thing as slightly mad, only nothing and then this, all-encompassing fury. What's pitiful about me, Blue? Tell me what's pitiful. He jumped up. Is it 'cause I work for everything I get? Is that what makes me pitiful and Gansey not? He shook the letter. Is it because I don't get this given to me? She didn't flinch, but something simmered in her eyes. No. His voice was terrible. He heard it. I don't want your damn pity. Her face was shocked. What did you say? She was looking at the box that served as his nightstand. Somehow, it had moved several feet away from the bed. The side was badly dented, its former contents scattered violently across the floor. Only now did he remember the act of kicking the box, but not the decision to kick it. It hadn't switched off the anger. For a long moment, Blue stared at him, and then she stood up. You be careful, Adam Parrish, 'cause one day you might get what you ask for. There might be girls in Henrietta who let you talk to them like that, but I'm not one of them. Now I'm going to sit on those stairs out there until my shift. If you can be human before then, come get me. If not, I'll see you later. She ducked a little to keep from smashing her head, and then she shut the door behind her. It would have been easier if she'd yelled or cried. Instead, his words just kept hitting flint inside his thoughts, again and again, another spark and another. She was just as bad as Gansey. Where does she get off? When he graduated and flew from this place and she was still trapped here, she'd feel stupid about all this. He wanted to open the door and shout this fact at her. He made himself stay where he was. After a moment, he calmed enough to see how his anger was a separate thing inside him. A dingy surprise gift from his father. He calmed enough to remember that if he waited long enough, carefully analyzing how it felt, the emotion would lose its inertia. It was the same as physical pain. The more he tried to mentally decide what made pain hurt, the less his brain seemed able to remember the pain at all. So he took apart the anger inside him. Is this what he felt like? He wondered. When he grabbed my sleeve as I was going out the door? Is this what made him shove my face into the fridge? Did he feel this when he passed by my bedroom door? Was this what he fought every time he remembered I existed? He calmed enough to realize it wasn't even Blue he had been angry at. She'd just been unlucky enough to be standing in the blast zone when he went off. He'd never escape. Not really. Too much monster blood in him. He'd left the den, but his breeding betrayed him. And he knew why he was pitiful. It wasn't because he had to pay for his school or because he had to work for a living. It was because he was trying to be something he could never be. The sham was pitiful. He didn't need to graduate. He needed Glendower. Some nights, he lured himself to sleep by imagining how he would word the favor for Glendower. He needed to get the words exactly right. Now he rolled phrases around his mouth, desperately reaching for one that would comfort him. Ordinarily, words would tumble and lull through his mind, but this time, all he could think was, fix me. Suddenly, he caught another image. Right after he did, he thought, what does that mean? One couldn't catch an image, and he certainly hadn't done it more than once. But the sensation lingered, an idea that he had glimpsed or felt or remembered some movement at the corner of his eye, a snapshot captured just behind his eyes. He had a strange, disconcerting feeling that he couldn't trust his senses, like he was tasting an image or smelling a feeling or touching a sound. It was the same as just a few minutes before, the idea that he'd glimpsed a slightly wrong reflection of himself. Adam's previous worries vanished replaced with a more immediate concern for this ragged body he was carting around in. He'd been hit so many times. He'd already lost his hearing in his left ear. Maybe something else had been destroyed on one of those tense, wretched nights. Then he caught another image. He turned. 9. When Adam called, Ronan, Noah, and Gansey were at the Dollar City in Henrietta loitering. Theoretically, they were there for batteries. Practically, they were there because both Blue and Adam had work. Ronan's shapeless anger always got worse at night, and Dollar City was one of the few stores in Henrietta that allowed pets. Gansey answered his phone as Ronan examined a package of erasers shaped like alligators. The Dayglow animals wore an assortment of 6 aghast expressions. Noah tried to skew his mouth to match as Chainsaw, buried in the crook of Ronan's arm, eyed them suspiciously. At the end of the aisle, the clerk viewed Chainsaw with equal distrust. When Dollar City had said, "Pets welcome," Dollar City wasn't certain they'd meant carrion birds. Ronan was very much enjoying the clerk's petulant gaze. "Hello? Oh, hey," Gansey said to the phone, touching a notebook with a handgun printed on the cover. The "oh, hey" was accompanied by a definite change in the timbre of his voice. That meant it was Adam, and that somehow stoked Ronan's anger. Everything was worse at night. "I thought you were still at work." "What?" "Oh, we're at the bourgeoisie playground." Ronan showed Gansey a plastic wall clock cleverly molded in the shape of a turkey. The wattle hanging below the clock face ticked off the seconds. "Mon Dieu," Gansey said. To the phone he said, "If you're not sure, it probably wasn't. A woman is hard to mistake for anything else." Ronan wasn't exactly sure why he was angry. Although Gansey had done nothing to invoke his ire, he was definitely part of the problem. Currently, he propped his cell between ear and shoulder as he eyed a pair of plastic plates printed with smiling tomatoes. His unbuttoned collar revealed a good bit of his collarbone. No one could deny that Gansey was a glorious portrait of youth, the well-tended product of a fortunate and moneyed pairing. Ordinarily, he was so polished that it was bearable, though, because he was clearly not the same species as Ronan's rough-and-ready family. But tonight, under the fluorescent lights of Dollar City, Gansey's hair was scuffed and his cargo shorts were a greasy ruin from mucking over the pig. He was bare-legged and sockless in his topsiders and very clearly a real human, an attainable human, and this somehow made Ronan want to smash his fist through a wall. Holding the phone away from his mouth, Gansey told them, "Adam thinks he saw an apparition at his place." Ronan eyed Noah. "I'm seeing an apparition right now." Noah made a rude gesture, a hilariously unthreatening act coming from him like a growl from a kitten. The clerk clucked audibly. Chainsaw took the clucking as a personal affront. She plucked irritably at the leather bands on Ronan's wrist, reminding him of Kavinsky's strange gift earlier. It was not an entirely comfortable feeling to think of the other boy studying him that closely. Kavinsky had gotten the 5 bands precisely right, down to the tone of the leather. Ronan wondered what he was hoping to achieve. "For how long?" Gansey asked the phone. Ronan rested his forehead on the topmost shelf. The metal edge snarled against his skull, but he didn't move. At night, the longing for home was ceaseless and omniscient, an airborne contaminant. He saw it in Dollar City's cheap oven mitts. That was his mother at dinner time. He heard it in the slam of the cash register drawer. That was his father coming home at midnight. He smelled it in the sudden whiff of air freshener. That was the family trips to New York. Home was so close at night. He could be there in 20 minutes. He wanted to smash everything off these shelves. Noah had wandered down the aisle, but now he gleefully returned with a snow globe. He stood behind Ronan until he pushed off the shelf to admire the atrocity. A seasonally decorated palm tree and 2 faceless sunbathers were trapped inside, along with a painted, erroneous statement, "It's always Christmas somewhere." "Glitter," whispered Noah reverentially, giving it a shake. Sure enough, it was not fake snow, but glitter that precipitated on the eternal holiday sands. Both Ronan and Chainsaw watched, transfixed as the colorful bits caught in the palm tree. Farther down the aisle, Gansey suggested to the phone, "You could come stay at Monmouth for the night." Ronan laughed sharply, loud enough for Gansey to hear. Adam was militant about staying at his place, even though it was horrible. Even if the room had been a 5-star accommodation, it would have been hateful, because it wasn't the bruised home Adam desperately and shamefully missed, nor was it Monmouth Manufacturing, the new home Adam's pride wouldn't allow. Sometimes Ronan thought Adam was so used to the right way being painful that he doubted any path that didn't come with agony. Gansey's back was turned to them. "Look, I don't know what you're talking about. Ramirez? I didn't talk to anyone at the church." "Yes. $2,400, I know that part. This meant they were talking about the Aglenby letter. Both Ronan and Gansey had gotten matching ones. Now Gansey's voice was low and furious. "At some point, it's not cheating." "No, you're right. You're right. I absolutely don't understand. I don't know, and I won't ever." Probably Adam had made the connection between his rent change and the tuition raise. It wasn't a complicated assumption, and he was clever. It was easy, too, to hang it on Gansey. If Adam had been thinking straight, though, he would have considered how it was Ronan who had infinite connections to St. Agnes, and how whomever was behind the rent change would have had to enter a church office with both a wad of cash and a burning intention to persuade a church lady to lie about a fake tax assessment. Taken apart that way, it seemed to have Ronan written all over it. But one of the marvelous things about being Ronan Lynch was that no one ever expected him to do anything nice for anyone. "It wasn't me," Gansey said, "but I'm glad it happened that way." "Fine. Take from that what you will." The thing was, Ronan knew what a face looked like just before it was about to break. He'd seen it in the mirror often enough. Adam had fracture lines all over him. Next to Ronan, Noah said, "Oh!" in a very surprised way. Then he flickered out. The snow globe crashed onto the ground where Noah's feet used to be. It left a damp, wobbly ellipse as it rolled away. Chainsaw, shocked, bit Ronan. He'd squeezed her as he leapt back from the sound. The clerk said, "Come on!" She hadn't seen the travesty, but she clearly knew one had occurred. "Don't get excited," Ronan said loudly. "I'll pay for it." He would have never admitted how his heart pounded in his chest. Gansey turned sharply, his face puzzled. The scene, Noah absent, ugly snow globe rolled half under a shelf, offered no immediate explanation. To Adam, he said, "Hold on." Abruptly, Ronan's entire body went cold. Not a little chilly, but utterly cold. The sort of cold that dries the mouth and slows the blood. His toes went numb, and then his fingers. Chainsaw let out a terrified creaking sound. She cried, "Kira!" He laid a frozen hand over her head, comforting her, though he was not comforted. Then Noah reappeared in a violent sputter, like the power crackling back on. His fingers clutched Ronan's arm. Cold seeped from the point of contact as Noah dragged heat to become visible. An absolutely perfect breath of Henrietta summer air dissipated around them, the scent of the forest when Noah had died. They all knew that Noah could drop the temperature in the room when he first manifested, but this scale was something new. "Whoa! Way to ask first, asshole," Ronan said, but he didn't push him off. "What was that?" Noah's eyes were wide. Gansey told Adam, "I'll call you back." The clerk said, "Are you boys done yet?" "Nearly," Gansey called back in his reassuringly honeyed voice, shoving his phone in his back pocket. "I'll be up for paper towels in a minute." What's happening here? This last bit was hissed to Ronan and Noah. Noah took a personal day. "I lost," Noah struggled for words. "There was an error. It went away. The line." "The ley line?" Gansey asked. Noah nodded once, a sloppy thing that was sort of a shrug at the same time. "There was nothing left for me." Releasing Ronan, he shook out his hands. "You're welcome, man," Ronan snarled. He still couldn't feel his toes. "Thanks. I didn't mean to." "You were there." "Oh, the glitter."
"Yes," Ronan replied crossly, "the glitter."
Gansey swiftly retrieved the leaking snow globe and disappeared for the front counter. He returned with a receipt and a roll of paper towels. Ronan asked, "What was up with Parrish?" He saw a woman in his apartment. He said she was trying to talk to him. He seemed a little freaked out. "I think the ley line must be surging." He didn't say, "Or maybe something terrible happened to Adam that day he sacrificed himself in Cabeswater. Maybe he's messed up all of Henrietta by waking up the ley line." Because they couldn't talk about that. Just like they couldn't talk about Adam stealing the Camaro that night. Or about him basically doing everything Gansey had asked him not to. If Adam was stupid about his pride, Gansey was stupid about Adam. Ronan echoed, "Ley line surging." "Right. Yeah, I'll bet that's it." All the whimsy of Dollar City was ruined. As Gansey led the way out, Noah said to Ronan, "I know why you're mad." Ronan sneered at him, but his pulse heaved. "Tell me then, Prophet." Noah said, "It's not my job to tell other people's secrets." 10. "I was thinking you could come with me," Gansey said carefully 2 hours later. He pressed the phone to his ear with one shoulder as he unrolled a massive scroll of paper across the floor of Monmouth Manufacturing. The numerous low lamps through the room made an array of searchlights across the paper. "To the party at my mom's. There might be an internship in there if you're good at it." On the other end of the phone, Adam didn't immediately reply. It was hard to say if he was thinking about it or being irritated about the suggestion. Gansey kept unrolling the paper. It was a high-resolution print of the ley line as seen from a casually interested satellite. It had cost a fortune to get the images spliced and then printed in color, but it would all be worth it if he spotted some oddity. If nothing else, they could use it to track their exploration. Also, it was pretty. From Ronan's room, he heard Noah's laugh. He and Ronan were throwing various objects from the second-story window to the parking lot below. There was a terrific crash. Ronan's voice rose, exasperated. "Not that one, Noah!"
"I'd have to see if I could get off work," Adam replied. "I think I can. Do you think I should?"
Relieved, Gansey said, "Oh, yes." He dragged his desk chair onto the corner of the print. It kept trying to roll back up on itself. He put a copy of Trioeth Unus Prithine on the other corner.
"Have you heard from Blue?" Adam asked.
"Tonight? She has work, doesn't she?"
Roll, roll, roll.
He nudged it with his foot to keep it straight. It was surprisingly satisfying to see acres and acres of forest and mountains and rivers unrolling across his floorboards. If he were a god, he thought, this would be precisely how he'd create his new world, unrolling it like carpet.
"Yeah, I just... Has she ever said anything to you about me?"
"Like what?"
A long silence. "About kissing, I guess."
Gansey paused in his rolling. As a point of fact, Blue had confessed a lot about kissing. Namely, that she'd been told her entire life that she'd kill her true love if she kissed him. It was strange to remember that moment. He doubted her, he recalled. He wouldn't have now. Blue was a fanciful but sensible thing, like a platypus, or one of those sandwiches that had been cut into circles for a fancy tea party. She'd also asked Gansey not to tell Adam about her confession.
"Kissing?" he repeated evasively. "What's going on?"
Another crash from Ronan's room, followed by diabolical laughter. Gansey wondered if he should stop them before vehicles with strobe lights did.
"I don't know. She doesn't want to," Adam said. "I don't blame her, I guess. I don't know what I'm doing."
"Have you asked her why she doesn't want to?" Gansey asked, though he didn't want to hear the answer. He was abruptly tired of the conversation.
"She said she was very young."
"She probably is." Gansey had no idea how old Blue was. He knew she'd just finished 11th grade.
Maybe she was 16. Maybe she was 18. Maybe she was 22 and just very short and remedial. I don't know, Gansey. Does that sound like a real thing? You've dated way more than me. I'm not dating now, except for Glendower. Gansey couldn't argue that point. Look, Adam, I don't think it's about you. I think she likes you fine. Adam clearly didn't like this answer, though, because he didn't reply. It gave Gansey enough time to remember the moment he'd first approached her at Nino's on Adam's behalf, how disastrous it had been. Since then, he'd considered a dozen different ways he could have done it better, which was foolish. It had all worked out, hadn't it? She was with Adam now. Whether or not Gansey had made a first-class prat of himself the moment they met didn't change anything. No way, man! Noah shouted, but he didn't sound like he meant it. His words were most of the way to a laugh already. No way! Gansey kicked the rolled print hard enough that it teetered crookedly out to its end, yards away out of the circles of light. Standing, he walked to the windows on the eastern wall of the factory. Leaning an elbow on the frame, he pressed his forehead against the glass to gaze on the great black spread of Henrietta below. Once, he had dreamt that he found Glendower. It wasn't the actual finding, but the day after. He wouldn't forget the sensation of the dream. It hadn't been joy, but instead, the absence of pain. He couldn't forget that lightness. The freedom. I don't want things to get ugly, Adam said finally. Are they ugly? No, I guess not. But somehow they always seem to get that way. Gansey watched tiny car lights diminish as they left Henrietta, reminding him of his miniature version of the town. An early illicit firework sprayed up in the foreground? Well, she's not really like a girl. I mean, sure, she's a girl. But it's not like when I was dating someone. It's blue. You could just ask her. We see her every day. Do you want me to talk to her? This was something he definitely 100% felt certain in his guts that he had no interest in doing. I'm really bad at talking, Gansey, Adam said earnestly, and you're really good at it. Maybe if it just comes up natural? Gansey's shoulders collapsed, his breath fogged the glass and vanished. Of course. Thanks, Adam paused. I just want something to be simple. So do I, Adam. So do I. Ronan's bedroom door burst open. Hanging on the doorframe, Ronan leaned out to peer past Gansey. He was doing that thing where he looked like both the dangerous Ronan he was now and the cheerier Ronan he had been when Gansey had first met him. Is Noah out here? Hold on, Gansey told Adam, then to Ronan. Why would he be?
No reason. Just no reason.
Ronan slammed his door. Gansey asked Adam, sorry, you still have that suit for the party? Adam's response was buried in the sound of the second-story door falling open. Noah slouched in. In a wounded tone, he said,
he threw me out the window.
Ronan's voice sang out from behind his closed door.
You're already dead!
What's happening over there? Adam asked. Gansey eyed Noah. He didn't look any worse for wear.
I have no idea. You should come over.
Not tonight, replied Adam.
I'm losing him, Gansey thought. I'm losing him to Cabeswater.
He had thought that by staying away from the forest, he'd keep the old Adam, put off the consequences of whatever had happened that night when everything started to go awry. But maybe it just didn't matter. Cabeswater would take him regardless. Gansey said, well, just make sure you have a red tie. 11. That night Ronan dreamt of trees. It was a massive old forest, oaks and sycamores pushing up through the cold mountain soil. Leaves skittered in the breeze. Ronan could feel the size of the mountain under his feet, the oldness of it. Far below, there was a heartbeat that wrapped around the world, slower and stronger and more inexorable than Ronan's own. He had been here before, lots of times. He'd grown up with this recurring dream forest. Its roots were tangled in his veins. The air moved around him, and in it he heard his name.
Ronan Lynch, Ronan Lynch, Ronan Lynch.
There was no one there but Ronan, the trees, and the things the trees dreamt of. He danced on the knife's edge between awareness and sleep. When he dreamt like this, he was a king. The world was his to bend, his to burn.
Ronan Lynch. Grey Warren. 2S. Grey Warren.
The voice came from everywhere and nowhere. The word Grey Warren made his skin prickle.
Girl, he said.
And there she was, peering cautiously from behind a tree. When Ronan had first dreamt of her, she'd had long, honey-blonde hair. But after a few years, it changed to a close-cropped pixie cut, mostly hidden by a white skull cap. Although he had aged, she had not. For some reason, she reminded Ronan of the old black-and-white photos of laborers in New York City. She had the same sort of forlorn orphan look. Her presence made it easier to pull things from his dreams. He reached a hand toward her, but she didn't immediately emerge. She peered around fearfully. Ronan couldn't fault her. There were terrifying things in his head.
Come on.
He didn't yet know what he wanted to take from this dream, but he knew that he was so alive and aware in it that it would be easy. But Orphan Girl remained out of reach, her fingers clinging to the bark.
Ronan, manos vestras, she said. Ronan, your hands.
His skin shivered and crawled, and he realized it was crawling with hornets, the ones that had killed Gansey all those years ago. There weren't many this time, only a few hundred. Sometimes he dreamt cars full of them, houses full of them, worlds full of them. Sometimes these hornets killed Ronan, too, in his dreams. But not tonight, not when he was the most poisonous thing in these trees, not when his sleep was clay in his fingers. They aren't hornets, he thought, and they weren't. When he lifted his hands, his fingers were coated with crimson ladybugs, each as vivid as a blood drop. They whirled into the air with their acrid summer scent. Every wing was a buzzing voice in a simple language. Orphan Girl, ever a coward, emerged only after they were gone. She and Ronan moved from one part of the forest to the next. She hummed a refrain of a pop song over and over again as the trees murmured overhead.
Ronan Lynch, loqueri, pro nobis. Speak for us.
Suddenly, he faced a striated rock nearly as tall as he was. Thorns and berries grew at its base. It was familiar in a way that was too solid to be a dream, and Ronan felt a ripple of uncertainty. Was this a dream he was in now, or was it a memory? Was this really happening?
You're sleeping, the girl reminded him in English.
He clung to her words, a king again. Facing the rock, he knew what he was meant to do, what he had already done. He knew it would hurt. The girl turned her narrow face away as Ronan seized the thorns and the berries. Every thorn prick was a hornet sting, threatening to wake him. He crushed them until his fingers were dark with juice and blood, dark as the ink on his back. He slowly traced words on the rock.
Arbores loqui latine. The trees speak Latin.
You've done this before, she said. Time was a circle, a rut, a worn tape Ronan never tired of playing. The voices whispered to him.
Gratias, tibi ago.
Thank you, the girl said. Don't forget the glasses. Ronan followed her gaze. Between the flowers and broken vines and fallen leaves was a gleaming white object. When he plucked it free, Kavinsky's sunglasses looked back at him, eyeless. He ran his thumb over the smooth surface of the plastic, fogged his breath over the tinted lenses. He did it until he could feel even the etched circle of the tiny screw in the earpiece. Dream to memory to reality. He lifted his eyes to the girl. She looked afraid. She always looked afraid these days. The world was a scary place. She said, take me with you. He woke up. That night, the gray man dreamt of being stabbed. At first, He felt each individual wound, particularly that first one. He was unbroken and entire, and then that wholeness was stolen by that thief, the knife. So that piercing was the worst. A half inch above his left collarbone, pinning him to the ground for half a breath. Then again, but closer to the knob of his shoulder, glancing off his collarbone. And then 2 inches below his belly button. The word gut was a verb and a noun. Another cut and another cut. Slippery. Then the gray man was the assailant. The hilt of the knife was ridged and permanent in his hand. He'd been stabbing this piece of meat for a lifetime. He'd been born when it started, and he'd die when he was done. It was the bite that kept him alive. The moment the blade parted a new inch of skin. The resistance, and then nothing. Catch and release. Then the gray man was the knife. He was a blade in the air, gasping, and then he was a weapon inside, holding his breath. He was voracious, chewing, never satisfied. Hunger was a species, and he was the best of that kind. The gray man opened his eyes. He looked at the clock. He rolled over and went back to sleep. That night, Adam didn't dream. Curled on the mattress, he covered his face with his summer hot arm. Sometimes, if he blocked his mouth and nose just this side of suffocation, sleep would overthrow him. But both regret and the memory of the brief apparition kept slumber at bay. The wrongness, the deadness of the woman still hung in the air of the room. Or maybe inside him. What did I do? He was awake enough to think of home. It's not home. It was never home. Those people didn't exist, and if they did, they were nothing to you. And to think of Blue's face when he lost his temper. He was awake enough to recall precisely the smell of the forest as he sacrificed himself. He was awake enough to wonder if he'd been making bad decisions for his entire life. If he'd been a bad decision himself even before he was born. He wished summer was over. At least when he was at Aglenby, he could turn over his papers to see the grades, concrete proof of his success at something. He was awake enough to think of the invitation from Gansey. There might be an internship in there. Adam knew it was a favor. Did that make it wrong? He'd said no for so long that he didn't know when to say yes. And maybe, a tiny, watchful part of his mind said, maybe it will be for nothing anyway. When they smell the Henrietta dirt beneath your fingernails. He hated the careful way Gansey had asked him about it, tiptoeing, just like Adam had learned to tiptoe around his father. He needed a reset button. Just push the reset button on Adam Parrish and start him again. He didn't sleep, and when he did, he didn't dream. 12. The following morning, Blue was perusing school summer reading when her Aunt Jimmy brought a plate full of smoldering plant matter through her bedroom. Jimmy, Orla's mother, was as tall as Orla, but several times wider. She had all of Orla's grace, too, which was to say that she knocked her hips into every piece of furniture in Blue's room. Every time she did, she said things like, "Mother lover," and "fasten it all." They sounded worse than real swear words. Blue lifted her bleary eyes from the page, her nostrils smarting from the smoke. "What are you doing?" "Smudging," Jimmy answered. She held the plate in front of the canvas trees Blue had stuck to her walls and blew on the bound herbs to direct the smoke at the art. "That terrible woman left so much bad energy." The terrible woman was Neve, Blue's half-aunt, who had disappeared earlier that year after practicing black magic in their attic. And smudging was the practice of using the smoke of sympathetic herbs to clear negative energy. Personally, Blue had always thought there must be better ways to get on a plant's good side than by setting it on fire. Now, Jimmy waved the lavender and sage in Blue's face. "Sacred smoke, cleanse the soul of this young woman before me and give her some common sense." "Hey!"
Blue protested, sitting up. I think I'm very sensible, thanks. There isn't mugwort in that, is there? Because I have things to do. Jimmy said mugwort improved her clairvoyance. She didn't seem to mind its temporarily mind-altering effects. Sullenly, sounding just like Orla, she said, No, your mother wouldn't let me. Blue silently thanked her mother. Gansey and Adam were supposed to be coming over, and the last thing she wanted was to be responsible for getting them mildly high. Although, she thought with more than a little discomfort, Adam might be improved by something that took the edge off. She wondered if he was ever going to say sorry. In that case, she said, would you do my closet too? Jimmy frowned. Was Neve ever in there? With Neve, Blue replied, you never know. I'll say an extra little prayer in there. The little prayer turned out to be a little longer than Blue had expected, and she fled the smoke after a few minutes. In the hallway, she discovered Jimmy had already opened the attic door in preparation for smudging Neve's old quarters. It felt like an invitation. With a glance down the hall, she stepped into the stairwell and climbed. Immediately, the air warmed and began to stink. The grubby smell of asafoetida, one of the charms Neve had used, still permeated the space, and the attic summer heat did nothing to improve upon it. At the top of the stairs, she hesitated. Most of Neve's things were still up here, but they'd been heaped and boxed on the throw-covered mattress for later removal. All of the masks and symbols had been removed from the slanted, unfinished walls, and the candles had been carefully packed taper side down in a plastic bin. But Neve's mirrors were undisturbed. Two full-length mirrors pointed directly at each other, and there was a deep black bowl sitting on the floor beside them. Neve's scrying bowl. The base was slicked with the memory of recent liquid, even though Neve hadn't been in this room for nearly a month. Blue wasn't sure who else would use it. She knew that Mora, Persephone, and Kala generally frowned upon the ritual. The technique was theoretically simple. The scryer looked into a mirror or dark bowl full of liquid, drew her mind into a space outside itself, and saw the future, or another location, in the reflection. In practice, Mora had told Blue that it was unpredictable and dangerous. The soul, she'd said, is vulnerable when it's outside the mind. The last time Blue had seen this bowl, Neve had been scrying into some place hidden on the ley line, possibly somewhere in Cabeswater. And when Blue had interrupted her, she'd found Neve possessed by whatever dark creature she'd discovered there. Now, in the attic's suffocating heat, Blue shivered. It was easy to forget the terror that had accompanied their hunt for Cabeswater, but the shiny circle in the base of the scrying bowl brought it all back in a second. Who's using you? Blue wondered, and of course, that was only the first half of the question. The other half was, and what are you looking for now? Ronan Lynch believed in heaven and hell. Once he'd seen the devil. It had been a low, late morning at the barns when the sun had burned off the mist and then burned off the chill and then burned the edges off the ground until everything shimmered with heat. It never got hot in those protected fields, but that morning the air sweated with it. Ronan had never seen cattle pant before. All of the cows heaved and stuck their tongues out as they frothed with the heat. His mother sent Ronan to put them in the shade of the cattle barn. Ronan had gone to the searing metal gate, and as he did, he'd glimpsed his father already in the barn. 4 yards away from him had stood a red man. He was not truly red, but the burned orange of a fire ant. And he was not truly a man because of the horns and the hooves. Ronan remembered the alienness of the creature, how real it had been. Every costume in the world had gotten it wrong, every drawing in every comic book. They'd all forgotten that the devil was an animal. Looking at the red man, Ronan had been struck by the intricacy of the body, how many miraculous pieces moved smoothly in harmony, no different from his own. Neil Lynch had had a gun in hand. The Lynches had an enormous number of guns of all sizes, and just as Ronan had opened the gate, his father had shot the thing about 13 times in the head. With a shake of its horns, the unharmed devil had presented its genitalia to Neil Lynch before bounding off. It was an image that had yet to leave Ronan. And so Ronan became a reverse evangelist. The truth burst and grew inside him, and it was laid upon him to share it with no one. No one was meant to see hell before they got there. No one should have to live with the devil. So many homilies on faith were ruined once you no longer required it for belief. Now it was Sunday, and as with every Sunday, he was headed to St. Agnes. Gansey wasn't with him. He belonged to some religion that only required church attendance on Christmas, but Noah came with. Noah had not been Catholic when he was alive, but recently he had decided to find religion. No one in the church ever noticed him, and it was possible God didn't either. But Ronan, as someone God possibly ignored as well, didn't mind the company. Today, Ronan grimly stepped through the great old doors and clawed some holy water from the font while the choir members narrowed their eyes at him. He scanned the pews for Declan. It was the devil who drove him to church every Sunday, but it was his brother Matthew who drove him to a pew beside Declan. His older brother sat in the rearmost pew, the knob of his skull resting on the wood, his eyes closed. As always, he dressed for church, collared shirt white as innocence, knot of his tie tight and sanctified, slacks obediently pressed. This week, however, Declan had zombie bruising beneath both of his eyes, a terrifically red, sutured split across a cheekbone, and a decidedly broken nose. Ronan's mood improved. He flicked holy water onto Declan's face from his still damp fingers. "What the hell happened to you?" The two women sitting three pews forward whispered to each other. The organ murmured in the background. Declan didn't open his eyes. "Burglary." He muttered it with as little effort as humanly possible, opening his mouth only wide enough for the word to escape. Ronan and Noah exchanged a look. "Oh, come on," Ronan said. For starters, it was Henrietta, and for finishers, it was Henrietta. No one got burgled, and if they did, they didn't get beaten up. And if anyone was going to get beaten up, it wouldn't be the Lynch brothers. There was very little worse than Ronan in Henrietta, and what worse there was too busy racing around in a little white Mitsubishi to burgle the remaining Lynches. What did they steal? "My computer. And a little money." "And your face." Declan just inhaled in response, slow and careful. Ronan slid into the pew and Noah moved in beside him, sitting at the very end. As he lowered the kneeler, he smelled the sharp antiseptic smell of hospital on his brother. For a moment, disoriented, he had to hold in his breath. He knelt and put his head down on his arms. The image behind his eyes was the bloody tire iron beside his father's head. "I didn't come out soon enough. I'm sorry. I'm sorry. Why of all the things I can do can I not change?" While whispered conversations ebbed and flowed around them, he focused on the image of his older brother's face and tried unsuccessfully to imagine the person that could beat Declan up. The only person who had ever succeeded in beating up a Lynch brother had been another Lynch brother. After he had exhausted this line of thought, Ronan gave in to the brief privilege of hating himself, as he always did in church. There was something satisfying about acknowledging this hatred, something relieving about this little present he allowed himself each Sunday. After a minute, the kneeler buckled as Matthew joined them. Even without the buck of the kneeler, Ronan would have known his presence by the heavy dose of cologne Matthew always seemed to think church required. "Hey, pal," Matthew whispered. He was the only person who could get away with calling Ronan pal. Matthew Lynch was a bear of a boy, square and solid and earnest. His head was covered with soft golden curls, completely unlike any of his other family members. And in his case, the perfect Lynch teeth were framed by an easy, dimpled smile. He had two brands of smile. The one that was preceded by a shy dip of his chin, a dimple, and then bam, smile. And the one that teased for a moment before bam, an infectious laugh. Females of all ages called him adorable. Males of all ages called him buddy. Matthew failed at many more things than either of his older brothers, but unlike Declan or Ronan, he always tried his hardest. Ronan had dreamt 1,000 nightmares about something happening to him. Matthew had unconsciously left enough room for Noah, but didn't offer a greeting. Ronan had once asked Noah if he chose to be invisible, and Noah, hurt, had replied enigmatically, "Rub it in, why don't you?"
"Did you see Declan's face?" Matthew whispered to Ronan. The organ played dolorously.
Declan kept his voice just low enough to be church level. "I'm right here."
"Burglar," Ronan said. Really, it was like the truth was a disease Declan thought might kill him.
"Sometimes when I call you," Declan muttered, still in the strange, low voice that came from him trying not to move his mouth while he spoke, "I actually need for you to pick up."
"Are we having a conversation?" Ronan asked. "Is that what's happening right now?"
Noah smirked. He didn't look very pious. "By the way, Joseph Kavinsky isn't someone I want you being around," Declan added. "Don't snort. I'm serious." Ronan merely invested a look with as much contempt as he could muster. A lady reached over the top of Noah to pat Matthew's head fondly before continuing down the aisle. She didn't seem to care that he was 15, which was all right because he didn't either. Both Ronan and Declan observed this interaction with the pleased expressions of parents watching their prodigy at work. Declan repeated, "Like actually dangerous." Sometimes, Declan seemed to think that being a year older gave him special knowledge of the seedier side of Henrietta. What he meant was, did Ronan know that Kavinsky was a cokehead? In his ear, Noah whispered, "Is crack the same thing as speed?" Ronan didn't answer. He didn't think it was a very church-appropriate conversation.
"I know you think you're a punk," Declan said, "but you aren't nearly as badass as you think you are."
"Oh, go to hell," Ronan snapped, just as the altar boys broached the rear doors.
"Guys," Matthew pleaded, "be holy." Both Declan and Ronan fell silent. They were silent all through the opening hymn, which Matthew sang cheerily along to, and the readings, which Matthew smiled pleasantly through, and the homily, which Matthew slept gently through. They were silent through communion, as Noah remained in the pew and Declan limped up the aisle and accepted the host, and Ronan closed his eyes to be blessed. "Please, God, what am I? Tell me what I am." And Matthew shook his head at the wine. And finally silent through the last hymn as the priest and the altar boys trailed back out of the church. They found Declan's girlfriend Ashley waiting on the sidewalk just outside the main doors. She was dressed in whatever had just been on the front page of People or Cosmopolitan, and her hair was dyed whatever shade of blonde matched it. She had 3 tiny gold earrings in each earlobe. She seemed oblivious to Declan's cheating, and Ronan hated her. To be fair, she also hated Ronan. Ronan snarled a smile at her.
"Afraid you'll catch fire if you come in?"
"I refuse to participate in a ceremony that doesn't, like, allow equal spiritual privileges to women," she said. She didn't meet Ronan's eyes when she said it, though, and she didn't look at Noah at all, though he'd snickered vaguely.
"Do you two buy your politics out of the same catalog?" asked Ronan.
"Ronan?" Declan started. Ronan flipped out his car keys.
"I was just leaving."
He allowed Matthew to perform a brotherly handshake that they had invented 4 years previously, and then he advised Declan, "Stay away from burglars." It was not as easy as one might expect for Ronan Lynch to street race. Most people obeyed the speed limit. For all the press road rage received, the majority of drivers were either too safety conscious, too shy, too principled, or too oblivious to provoke. Even those who might have considered a few minutes of traffic light drag racing were generally aware that their vehicles were not suited to the task. Races were not to be found just lying on the street. They had to be cultivated. So this was how Ronan Lynch found trouble. A brightly colored car, for a start. Ronan had spent hours of his life as the only black car in a short, straightforward game of candy-coated vehicles. He looked for hatchbacks, coupes, almost never a convertible. No one wanted to mess up their hair.
This was a street racer's wish list. Aftermarket parts on any sort of car, yawning exhaust pipes, asphalt scraping ground effects, cavernous hood scoops, smoked headlights, mismatched flames painted on fenders, any car that came with a wing. The more it looked like a handle to lift the car, the better. The silhouette of a shaved head or a hat jerked sideways was a promising sign, as was an arm hanging over the door. A deeply tanned hand braced on the mirror was better. Thumping bass was a call to battle. So were vanity plates, so long as they didn't say things like hot girl or love bunny. Bumper stickers were a turn-off unless they were college radio. Oh, and horsepower didn't count for anything. Half the time, the best sports cars were piloted by middle-aged bankers fearful of what might lie beneath their hood. Ronan used to avoid cars with multiple passengers, too, figuring that a solo driver was more likely to burn rubber at a light. But now he knew that the right sort of passengers would egg on an ordinarily tame driver. There was nothing Ronan liked better than a skinny, tanned kid half-hanging out of a noisy, mostly dead-red Honda full of his friends. And this was how it started. Nose up to the light, meet the driver's eyes, shut off the air code to give the car a few extra horsepower, rev the engine, smile like danger. This was how Ronan found trouble, except for when the trouble was Kavinsky, because then it found him. After church, Ronan and Noah headed in the general direction of the hellish affluent subdivision where Kavinsky lived with his mother. Ronan had half a thought that he might put the dream pair of sunglasses in Kavinsky's mailbox or tuck them in the windshield wipers of the Mitsubishi. The BMW's air conditioning was on full blast beneath the furious midday glare. Cicadas shrilled at one another. There were no shadows anywhere. "Company," said Noah. Kavinsky rolled up beside the BMW at an intersection. Above them, the traffic light turned green, but the street behind them was empty, and neither car moved. Ronan's palms were suddenly sweaty. Kavinsky rolled down his window. Ronan followed suit. "Fag," Kavinsky said, stepping on his gas pedal. The Mitsubishi wailed and shuddered a bit. It was a glorious and hideous piece of work. "Russian," Ronan replied. He stepped on his gas pedal, too. The BMW growled a little lower.
"Hey, now, let's not make this ugly."
Opening the center console, Ronan pulled out the sunglasses he'd dreamt the night before. He tossed them through his open window onto Kavinsky's passenger seat. The light turned yellow and then red. Kavinsky picked up the glasses and studied them. He knocked his own sunglasses halfway down his nose and studied them some more. Ronan was gratified to note how closely the new pair resembled them. The only thing he'd gotten wrong was that he'd made the tint a bit darker. Surely Kavinsky, master forger, should appreciate them. Finally, Kavinsky slid his gaze over to Ronan. His smile was sly, pleased that Ronan recognized the game.
"Well done, Lynch. Where did you find them?"
Ronan smiled thinly. He turned off the air conditioning.
"That's how it's gonna be. Hard to get?"
The opposing light turned yellow.
"Yes," said Ronan.
The traffic light above them turned green. Without any particular prelude, both cars exploded off the mark. For 2 seconds, the Mitsubishi snarled ahead, but then Kavinsky screwed the shift from third to fourth. Ronan did not. He blew by. Just as Ronan tore around a corner, Kavinsky honked his horn twice and made a rude gesture. Then Ronan was out of sight and speeding on his way back to Monmouth Manufacturing. In the rearview mirror, he allowed himself the slightest of smiles. This was what it felt like to be happy. 13. Blue very much liked having the boys over to her house. Their presence at the house was agreeable for several different reasons. The absolute simplest one was that Blue sometimes got tired of being 100% of the non-psychic population of 300 Fox Way, more and more often these days, and that percentage improved dramatically when the boys were over. The second reason was that Blue saw all the boys, particularly Richard Campbell Gansey III, in a very different light when they were there. Rather than the glossy, self-assured boy he'd been when she'd first met him, 300 Fox Way Gansey was a self-deprecating onlooker, at once eager and unsuited for all of the intuitive arts. He was a privileged tourist in a primitive country, flatteringly curious, unknowingly insulting, quite certainly unable to survive if left to his own devices. And the third reason was that it suggested permanence. Blue had acquaintances at school, people she liked, but they weren't forever. While she was friendly with a lot of them, there was no one that she wanted to commit to for a lifetime, and she knew this was her fault. She'd never been any good at having casual friends. For Blue, there was family, which had never been about blood relation at 300 Fox Way, and then there was everyone else. When the boys came to her house, they stopped being everyone else. Currently, both Adam and Gansey were situated in the narrow bowels of the house. It was a wide-open, promising sort of sunny day. It invaded through every window. Without any particular discussion, Gansey and Blue had come to the decision that today was a day for exploring once Ronan arrived. Gansey sat at the kitchen table in an aggressively green polo shirt. By his left hand was a glass bottle of a fancy coffee beverage he had brought with him. By his right hand was one of Mara's healing teas. For several months now, Blue's mother had been working on a line of helpful teas to augment their income. Blue had learned early on that helpful was not a synonym for delicious and had very vocally removed herself from the test group. Gansey didn't know any better, so he accepted what he was given. "I don't think I can wait any longer, but I would like to minimize the risk," he said as Blue rummaged in the fridge. Someone had filled an entire shelf with disgusting store-brand pudding. "I don't think we can ever make it completely safe, but surely there is a way to be more cautious." For a moment, Blue thought he was talking about the process of drinking one of Mara's teas. Then she realized he was talking about Cabe's water. Blue loved it in a way that was hard to hold inside herself. She'd always loved the big beech tree in their backyard and the oaks that lined Fox Way and forests in general, but nothing had prepared her for Cabe's water's trees. Ancient and twisted and sentient, and they'd known her name. It felt an awful lot like a hint of something more. Mora watched Gansey carefully. Blue suspected this was not because of anything Gansey was saying, but because she was waiting for him to take a drink of whatever horrid potion she had steeping in that cup in front of him. "I know what you're going to say," Blue said, settling on a yogurt. It had fruit on the bottom, but she'd eat around it. She threw herself into a chair at the table. "You're going to say, well then, don't take Blue with you." Her mother flipped a hand like, "If you knew, why'd you ask?" Gansey said, "What? Oh, because Blue makes things louder?" Crossly, Blue realized that Gansey had now called her Jane so often that it felt strange to hear him say her real name. "Yes," Mora replied. "But I actually wasn't going to say that, even though it's true. I was going to say that this place must have rules. Everything involved in energy and spirit has rules. We just don't always know them. So it looks unpredictable to us, but it's really just because we're idiots. Are you sure you want to go back?" Gansey took a drink of his healing tea. Mora's chin jutted as she observed the lump of it heading down his throat. His face remained precisely the same, and he said absolutely nothing, but after a moment he made a gentle fist of his hand and thumped his breastbone. "What did you say that was good for?" he asked politely. His voice was a little odd until he cleared his throat. "General wellness," Mora said. "Also, it's supposed to manage dreams." "My dreams?" he asked. Mora raised a very knowing eyebrow. "Who else's would you be managing?" "Also, it helps with legal matters." Gansey had been swallowing as much of his fancy coffee as he could possibly manage without breathing, but he stopped and put the bottle on the table with a clink.
Do I need help with legal matters?
Mora shrugged.
Ask a psychic.
Mom, Blue said.
Seriously.
To Gansey, she prompted. Cave's water.
Oh, right.
Well, no one else has to go with me, he said. But the incontrovertible fact remains that I am looking for a mystical king on a ley line, and it is a mystical forest on a ley line. I can't discount that coincidence. We can look elsewhere, but I think Glendower's there. And I don't want to waste time now that the ley line's awake. I feel like time's running out.
Are you sure you still want to find him?
Mora asked.
Blue already knew this question was irrelevant. Without cutting her gaze over to him, she already knew what she would see. She would see a rich boy dressed like a mannequin and coiffed like a newscaster. But his eyes were like the dreaming pool in Caveswater. He hid the insatiable wanting well. But now that she'd seen it once, she couldn't stop seeing it. But he wouldn't be able to explain it to Mora. And he would never really have to explain it to Blue. It was his something more. Very formally, he said, "Yes, I do."
"It could kill you," Mora said.
Then there was the awkward moment that arrives when two-thirds of the people in the room know that the other third is supposed to die in fewer than 9 months, and the person who is meant to die is not one of the ones in the know.
"Yes," Gansey said, "I know. I've done it before. Die, I mean."
"Do you not like the fruit bits? That's the best part."
He directed this last statement to Blue, who gave him her mostly empty yogurt cup. He was very clearly done with talking about death.
Mora sighed, giving up, just as Calla stormed into the kitchen. Calla was not angry. She merely stormed whenever possible. She ripped open the fridge and tore a pudding cup from it. As Calla spun with the hated store-brand pudding in her hand, she shook it at Gansey and thundered, "Just remember that Caveswater is a video game that everyone in it has been playing for a lot longer than you. They all know where to get the level-ups." She plowed from the room. Mora followed her.
"Well," said Gansey.
"Yes," agreed Blue. After a second, she pushed back her chair to follow Mora, but Gansey stretched a hand out.
"Wait," he said in a low voice.
"Wait what?" With a glance out toward the hall and reading room, he said, Adam. Instantly, Blue thought of Adam losing his temper. Her cheeks warmed.
"What about him?"
Gansey rubbed a thumb over his lower lip. It was a pensive habit, performed so frequently that it was surprising he had anything left to cover his bottom teeth.
"Have you told him about that no-kissing curse thing?"
If Blue had thought her cheeks were warm before, it was nothing compared to the blaze raging in them now.
"You didn't tell him, did you?"
He looked delicately aggrieved.
"You told me not to."
"Well, no, I haven't."
"Don't you think you should?"
The kitchen didn't seem very private, and they'd both unconsciously leaned as close as possible to keep their voices from carrying.
Blue hissed, "It's all very under control. I don't really want to be discussing this with you, of all people."
"Of all people?" Gansey echoed.
"What sort of all people am I?"
She had no idea now.
Flustered, she replied,
"You're not my grandmother or something?"
"You'd talk about this with your grandmother? I cannot possibly imagine discussing my dating life with mine. She's a lovely woman, I suppose, if you like them bald and racist."
He glanced around the kitchen as if he were looking for someone.
"Where is yours, anyway?
Isn't every female relative of yours in this house somewhere?"
Blue whispered furiously.
"Don't be
uncouth?
Uncouth?
Disrespectful. My grandmothers are both dead."
"Well, Jesus, what did they die of?"
"Mom always said meddling."
Gansey completely forgot they were being secretive and let out a tremendous laugh. It was a powerful thing, that laugh. He only did it once, but his eyes remained shaped like it. Something inside her did a complicated tug.
"Oh, no," she thought, but then she calmed herself.
"Richard C. Gansey III has a nice mouth. Now I know he has nice eyes when he laughs, too. This still isn't love.
She also thought, Adam, remember Adam.
It makes sense that there's a family history for your condition, he said. Do you eat all of the men in the family? Where do they go? Does this house have a basement?
Lou shoved out her chair and stood up. It's like boot camp. They can't hack it, poor things.
Poor me, he said.
Yep. Wait here.
She was a little relieved to leave him at the table. Her pulse felt like she'd been running. She found Maura and Calla still in the hall conferring in low voices. She told her mother, Look, we're definitely all going to Caveswater. This afternoon when Ronan's done, that's the plan. We're sticking to the plan.
Maura appeared a lot less distressed by this statement than Blue had feared. In fact, she didn't look very distressed at all.
Why are you telling me? Maura asked.
Why is your face so red?
Because you're my mother. Because you're an authority figure. Because you're supposed to inform people of your travel plans when you're hiking on dangerous trails. This is what my face always looks like.
Hmm, said Maura.
Hmm, said Calla. Suspiciously, Blue asked, You're not going to tell me not to go.
Not this time.
No point, Calla agreed.
Also, there's a scrying bowl in the attic, Blue said.
Her mother peered into the reading room.
No, there's not.
Blue insisted. Someone's been using it.
No, they haven't.
With an edge to her voice, Blue said, You can't just say it's not there and no one's using it, because I'm not an infant and I use my own eyes and brain all the time.
What do you want me to tell you then? Maura asked.
The truth. I just told you the truth.
She did, Gansey called from the kitchen.
Shut up, Blue and Calla said at once. Maura lifted a hand.
Fine, I used it.
For what?
Calla said, to look for butternut.
My father.
Blue probably shouldn't have been surprised.
Neve had been asked there to find her father, and although Neve was gone, the mystery of her father's whereabouts remained.
I thought you said scrying was a bad idea.
It's like vodka, Calla said. It really depends on who's doing it.
With her spoon poised over her pudding cup, she peered into the other room just as Maura had. Blue craned her neck to see what they were looking at. It was just Adam. He sat in the reading room by himself, the diffuse morning light rendering him soft and dusty. He had removed one of the tarot decks from its bag and lined all of the cards face up in three long rows. Now he leaned on the table and studied the image on each, one at a time, shuffling on his elbows to the next when he was through. He looked nothing like the Adam who'd lost his temper and everything like the Adam she had first met. That was what was frightening, though. There'd been no warning.
Maura frowned. In a low voice, she said, I think I need to have a conversation with that boy.
Someone does, Calla replied, heading up the stairs. Each stair groaned a protest for which she punished the next with a stomp. Not me. I've outgrown train wrecks.
Blue, alarmed, said, Is he a train wreck?
Her mother clucked her tongue. Calla likes drama.
Train wreck. When a train takes a long time to go off the tracks, I don't like to call it a wreck. I like to call it a derailment.
From upstairs, Blue heard Calla's delighted cackle.
I hate both of you, Blue said, as her mother laughed and galloped up the stairs to join Calla.
You're supposed to use your powers for good, you know.
After a moment, Adam said to her without lifting his eyes, I could hear y'all, you know.
Blue hoped fervently that he was only talking about Maura and Calla and not about her kitchen conversation with Gansey.
Do you think you're a train wreck?
That would mean I was on the tracks to start with, he replied. Are we going to Caveswater when Ronan's done?
Gansey appeared beside Blue in the doorway. He shook his empty bottle at her.
Fair trade, he told her, in a way that indicated he had selected a fair trade coffee beverage entirely so that he could tell Blue that he had selected a fair trade coffee beverage so that she could tell him, well done with your carbon footprint and all that jazz.
Blue said, better recycle the bottle.
He dazzled a smile at her before knocking on the door jamb with his fist.
Yes, Parrish. We're going to Caveswater.
14. You could ask anyone.
300 Fox Way, Henrietta, Virginia, was the place to go for the spiritual, the unseen, the mysterious, and the yet to occur. For a not unreasonable fee, any of the women under its roof, bar blue, would read your palm, pull your cards, cleanse your energy, connect you with deceased relatives, or listen to the dreadful week you had just lived through. During the business day, clairvoyance was often work. But on days off, when the mixed drinks emerged, it often became a game. Mora, Calla, and Persephone scavenged the house for magazines, books, cereal boxes, old decks of tarot cards, anything with words or images. One woman selected an image and hid it from the others, and the other two experimented with how accurate they could get their guesses. They made predictions with their backs to one another, with the cards splayed, with different numbers of candles on the table, while standing in buckets of water, calling up and down 3 or 7 stairs from the front hallway. Mora called it continuing education. Calla called it turning tricks. Persephone called it that thing we could do if there's nothing on television. That day, after Blue and Gansey and Adam had gone, there was no work to be done. Sundays were quiet, even for non-churchgoers. It wasn't that the women of 300 Fox Way weren't spiritual on Sunday. It was that they were spiritual every day, and so Sunday didn't particularly stand out. After the teens left the house, the women abandoned work and set up the game in the shabby but comfortable living room. "I'm very nearly drunk enough to be transcendent," Calla said after a space. She was not the only psychic drinking, but she was the closest one to transcendence. Persephone peered dubiously into the bottom of her own glass. In a very small voice, her voice was always small, she said sadly, "I am not drunk at all." Mora offered, "It's the Russian in you." "Estonian," Persephone replied. At that moment, the doorbell rang. Mora swore delicately, one well-chosen and highly specific word. Calla swore indelicately, several more words with rather fewer syllables. Then Mora went for the front door and reappeared in the living room with a tall man. He was very gray. He wore a dark gray V-neck T-shirt that emphasized the muscular slope to his shoulders. His slacks were a deeper gray. His hair was an ashy blonde, drained of color, and so was the fashionable weak old facial hair around his mouth. Even his irises were gray. It escaped none of the women in the room that he was handsome. "This is Mr.," he smiled in a knowing sort of way, "Gray." All of the women's mouths twisted into their own knowing sort of smile. Mora said, "He wanted a reading."
"We're closed," Calla said, utterly dismissive.
"Calla is rude," Persephone said in her dull voice. "We are not closed, but we are busy."
This was said with a question in her voice and an anxious glance toward Mora. "That's what I told him," Mora said. "However, it turns out that Mr. Gray doesn't really need a reading. He's a novelist researching psychics. He just wants to observe." Calla rattled the ice in her glass. One of her eyebrows looked exceptionally skeptical. "What do you write, Mr. Gray?" He smiled easily at her. They noticed he had extraordinarily straight teeth. "Thrillers. Do you read much?" She merely hissed and tipped her glass toward him, plum lip mark first. "Do you mind if he stays?" Mora asked. "He knows poetry." Calla sneered.
"Give me a stanza and I'll fetch you a drink."
Without the slightest hesitation or suggestion of self-consciousness, the gray man placed his hands in the pockets of his dark gray slacks and said,
"Where has gone the steed? Where has gone the youth? Where has gone the giver of treasure? Where are the feasting seats? Where the revelry in the hall? Alas, bright goblet! Alas, mailed warrior! Alas, prince's glory! How that time has passed away, obscured beneath the crown of night, as if it never were."
Calla lifted her lips from her teeth.
"Do it in the original old English and I'll put alcohol in that drink."
He did. Calla went to get him a drink.
After she had returned and the gray man had been encouraged to sit on the worn couch, Mora said, "I'll warn you that if you try anything, Calla has mace." By way of demonstration, Calla handed him his drink and then removed a small black container of pepper spray from her small red purse. Mora gestured toward the third member of their group. "And Persephone is Russian."
"Estonian,"
Persephone corrected softly. "And," Mora made an extremely convincing fist, "I know how to punch a man's nose into his brain." "What a coincidence," the gray man said genially. "So do I." He watched with an attentiveness both polite and flattering as Mora scraped her cards up from the sofa cushions. He leaned to pick up one she had missed. "This fellow looks unhappy," he observed. The art depicted a man stuck with 10 swords. The victim lay on his face, as most people did after being stuck with 10 swords. "That's a fellow after Calla's done with him," Mora said. "Good news for him is that the 10s represent the end of a cycle. This card represents the absolute worst it'll get."
"Does seem like there's not much worse than 10 points in your back and dust in your mouth," the gray man agreed.
"Look," Mora said, "his face looks a little like yours." The gray man